9. Jakarta is coming. Paradigm shift. The governments established in Brazil in 1964 and in Indonesia in 1965 were not Washington's perfectly obedient servants. They remained nationalist in a way and pushed back at times against the United States, nor were they neoliberal in the sense that word is used today. The state remained significantly involved in the economy and attempted to guide national development. They were simply capitalist, well, a certain type of capitalist, authoritarian regimes, well integrated into the expanding Western system. But they sure had a lot in common, and these two anti-communist dictatorships were the best allies that Washington's foreign interventions had ever created. Things worked out so well that the U.S. government and its allies began to use them as a model. Brazil, the largest country in Latin America, began working with the gringos to fight communism and create copycat regimes in its neighborhood. Indonesia, the largest country in Southeast Asia, would use anti-communism as an excuse to expand its influence eastward with Washington's approval, and the leader of Southeast Asia's second-largest country soon used a script similar to Suharto's in order to consolidate his own right-wing dictatorship. Both military dictatorships, Brazilian and Indonesian, would quibble with Washington over this or that economic issue or foreign policy decision, but the big questions were settled. They were in the Western camp and fiercely opposed to communist expansion. They were porous to international investment and happy to export raw materials to rich countries under the existing terms governing the international economy. They certainly were not trying to rewrite the rules of the global economy or use the power of a unified third world to shift influence back to the majority of the world's peoples, to those who had been structurally disadvantaged by centuries of colonialism. They took advice from Western advisors and U.S.-trained economists. In Indonesia, this was the Berkeley Mafia, a set of economists trained at the University of California who worked with Suharto. In Brazil, the coup was aided by the conspiring and propagandizing of the U.S.-funded Instituto de Pesquisas e Estudos Sociais, Research and Social Studies Institute, which remained active under the dictatorship until 1972. Both regimes were strongly influenced by modernization theory, and both countries began to experience economic growth. That was almost entirely sucked up by a small elite, but the GDP growth counted to foreign investors, and they could be sold as success stories. And in both cases, the countries had stable governments made up of local rulers who could trace their legitimacy to some Brazilian or Indonesian past, rather than appearing to their populations and the world as the obvious imposition of Washington. In the long term, this was all much better than what had been created in Guatemala or Iran in the 1950s. Guatemala had plunged into a brutal civil war. Iran's government alienated its neighbors and much of the population, and this would explode very dramatically in Washington's face in the next decade. Both Indonesia and Brazil were anti-communist dictatorships, and this doesn't only have consequences on the international stage. Internally, when anti-communism is the ruling ideology, almost the national religion, any legitimate complaint from below can easily be dismissed as communist. Anything that would be an obvious inconvenience to the small clique of rich families that run the country can be easily categorized as dangerous revolution and cast aside. This includes any whiff of socialism or social democracy, any land reform, and any regulation that would reduce monopoly power and allow for more efficient development and market competition. It includes unions and any normal demands for workers' rights. No one seriously pretended Brazil or Indonesia was a democracy, but this is not how capitalism is supposed to work either. This arrangement may be just as far from the system that economics textbooks describe as Soviet society was from the sketches of socialism provided by Karl Marx. In capitalism, feudal lords are not supposed to be running much of the country as their own personal fiefdoms. Market inefficiencies, like massive corruption, are supposed to disappear as the result of competition. There is supposed to be a give and take between the various elements in the economy. There is supposed to be space for new and innovative firms to emerge, challenge entrenched interests, and diversify national production. But in the system set up in Brazil and Indonesia, the logic of survival required people to attach themselves to a corrupt, rapacious, and wasteful apparatus at the top of society, or risk falling down into the abyss themselves and become a poorly paid worker in the extraction machine. Young Barack Obama had seen what this dynamic did to his stepfather. Guilt is a luxury only foreigners can afford, Lolo told Barack's mother. Lolo did understand. She didn't know what it is like to lose everything, to wake up and feel her belly eating itself. Without absolute concentration, one could easily slip, tumble backward. There's a term that broadly describes this kind of economic arrangement. The people of Indonesia and Brazil lived under crony capitalism. This was a very different reality from that of Washington's European capitalist allies. Francisca and her family arrived in Holland in 1968 and saw immediately how different Western Europe's dynamic, successful societies were from the Suharto regime. The Communist Party had won a few seats in the most recent Dutch election and participated in parliament. In France and Italy, the Communist parties aligned with Moscow were still major players. The PCF, the Parti Communiste Français, got more than 20% of the vote in 1967 and formed parliamentary opposition with the socialists and radicals. The Italian communists had gotten second place in the previous election and held solid chunks of the country as their loyal base. In West Germany, there was no influential communist party, but the main center-left party, the second-place Social Democrats, was founded as a Marxist party while Marx was still alive, and its leaders had chosen a more moderate path than the Leninists because of their success working within capitalist democracy. The last time Francisca had seen Western Europe, just after the war, it was very different. Back in the 1940s, access to meat and butter was strictly limited, and everyone was scrambling to rebuild their lives. In the 1960s, it was just rich and relaxed. The region's economies had been rebuilt along more American lines, thanks to the Marshall Plan, but these were not fanatically anti-communist nations when it came to their own affairs. Certainly not as much as the U.S., and nowhere near as much as Indonesia or Brazil. Even though the supposed Red Menace was just a few miles to the east ready to swallow them up, Western Europeans were far less afraid of it than the United States, sitting half a world away. It was very clear to Francisco why Europeans were allowed to experiment with social democracy and even communist politics while her country had been taken away from her forever. Racism, very simply. White Europeans are offered tolerance and sympathetic treatment while we are not. When Frank Wisner and Howard Jones were working to re-engineer West Germany's financial system after World War II, the U.S. government wiped out all public and private debt as they created the new Deutschmark. One shudders to think how a major third world leader perceived as anti-American or communist would have been treated if his country tried the same thing after a war of independence. In Western Europe's capitalist democracies, moderate and radical left-wing parties alike served as constant critics of the economic order from within the system without ever taking it over entirely. Of course, the CIA was still active in Europe, scheming in ways we still don't really understand. The Operation Gladio Stay Behind networks that grew out of Wisner's early days continued into the 1980s. But when European governments shifted too far right for citizens, voters shifted to the parties on the left and vice versa, and that was allowed. Why did Cold War Washington let Western Europe get away with all this light socialism when similar policy orientations led to violent intervention in the Third World? Was it only that, as Francisca said, Americans simply trusted their European cousins, who were white and therefore responsible, to handle the task of managing democracy? A complementary explanation might be that these countries, some still overseeing remnants of colonial empire, were incredibly rich and powerful. They were much harder to push around, even if Washington had wanted to, and perhaps, more importantly, they sat at the top of the world economy. They were being fully integrated into the U.S.-led system, and so there was much less of a risk they would try to radically reshape the global order because it had served them quite well. There was no opposition allowed in Brazil or Indonesia, however, which meant that elites could get away with everything. Venality and violence ruled the day in Jakarta and Brasilia. With the population too terrified to speak up, corruption exploded. In the early days of the Suharto regime, U.S. oil executives bragged that they were taking advantage of exactly those dynamics as they dined in front of Barack Obama's mother. His government, along with the U.S.-backed Mobutu regime in the Congo, would go on to set world historical records for corruption. Of course, the regime that Suharto set up was founded on mass violence, and by the late 1960s, Indonesia was operating a system of U.S.-supported concentration camps comparable to the worst years of the Soviet Union. But Brazil slid towards state terror slowly. When General Castelo Branco took over in 1964, he had the backing of large portions of the old political order, but it slowly became clear that his real base of support was in the barracks and the boardrooms. In order to survive, he couldn't turn his back on the reactionary forces in the military or on the business class, both of which were making demands that required more forceful, long-term dictatorship to fulfill. But he could afford to alienate the more moderate forces that supported the 1964 coup, believing there would be new elections soon. The generals and the capitalists, who wanted radical anti-communism and steady profits, were the only thing propping up the government now that democracy was gone and politics was reduced to its most base elements. The nice liberals and the Democrats could be ignored. So they were. Over the next few years, a series of institutional acts consolidated power in the hands of the generals and brought back indirect elections, meaning that Congress simply selected the president. Again, the Soviet-aligned Communist Party took a very moderate line compared to the other forces on the left. The Brazilian Communist Party, PCB, called for a united coalition of all the country's forces that were now opposed to the dictatorship, including those that had initially supported the 1964 coup, to press for democratic freedoms. Asking for anything more, including any kind of socialism in the short term, was irresponsible and reckless, adventurism and petty bourgeois haste, according to the Brazilian communists. It was groups of soldiers and students who looked to Che Guevara and Havana rather than Brezhnev and Moscow that took more radical actions in 1965 to 1968 and spooked the regime. The PCB remained nonviolent. Right-wing extremists did not. They carried out a series of bombings, which were blamed on the left, with the goal of prolonging and radicalizing the military dictatorship. The generals proclaimed AI-5, or Institutional Act No. 5, in December 1968, giving the military leaders even more power, imposing censorship, and suspending constitutionally guaranteed rights in the name of national security. Thus began the Brazilian Anos de Chumbo, or Years of Lead, which meant torture and murder. The worst years of Brazil's dictatorship were largely overseen by Emilio Garastazu Medici, a hard-line gaucho general who took over the presidency in 1969. In the first years of the military dictatorship, students, artists, and intellectuals could still protest the regime, and violent repression was reserved for union leaders and the organized left. In the Anos de Chumbo, from 1969 to 1974, all of that changed. Anyone could be suspected of being a subversive and taken off to a basement in Sao Paulo or Rio de Janeiro for rounds of torture that might end in death. In addition to their constant contact with the U.S. government, soldiers learned techniques that the French had developed in Algeria, like the use of electric shocks. Medici's forces largely concentrated their efforts on suspected members of Brazil's small urban guerrilla movements, often young Marxists drawn from the educated middle classes who hoped to overthrow the dictatorship. In 1970, they arrested a young woman of Bulgarian descent. Dilma Rousseff later testified that they tortured her for weeks, hanging her upside down from a stick in a technique known as the parrot's perch, beating teeth out of her head, and applying electric shocks. The military also put down a small rural rebellion in the Araguaia River Basin, organized by the Maoist PCdoB, the new communist party that had split off from the PCB in 1962, and took inspiration from both Che Guevara and the communists in the Chinese Civil War. Brazil's military suppressed its internal opposition with relative ease and never turned to mass violence on the scale employed in Indonesia or other Latin American countries. But the terror was very real. Paulo Coelho, now a famous author, remembers clearly what happened to those who fell on the wrong side of the law. It happened to him. A group of armed men broke into his apartment, he recalls. They start going through drawers and cabinets, but I don't know what they're looking for. I'm just a rock songwriter. One of them, more gentle, asks that I accompany them just to clarify some things. The neighbor sees all this and warns my family, who immediately panic. Everyone knew what Brazil was living at the time, even if it wasn't covered in the newspapers. On the way, the taxi is blocked by two cars. A man with a gun in his hands exits from one of the cars and pulls me out. I fall to the ground and feel the barrel of the gun in the back of my neck. I look at a hotel in front of me and think, I can't die so soon. I fall into a kind of catatonic state. I don't feel afraid. I don't feel anything. I know the stories of other friends who have disappeared. I will disappear, and the last thing I will see is a hotel. The man picks me up, puts me on the floor of his car, and tells me to put on a hood. The car drives around for maybe half an hour. They must be choosing a place to execute me, but I still don't feel anything. I've accepted my destiny. The car stops. I'm dragged out and beaten as I'm pushed down what appears to be a corridor. I scream, but I know no one is listening because they are also screaming. Terrorist, they say. You deserve to die. You're fighting against your country. You're going to die slowly, but you're going to suffer a lot first. Paradoxically, my instinct for survival begins to kick in little by little. I'm taken to the torture room with a raised floor. I stumble on it because I can't see anything. I ask them not to push me, but I get punched in the back and fall down. They tell me to take off my clothes. The interrogation begins with questions I don't know how to answer. They ask me to betray people I have never heard of. They say I don't want to cooperate, throw water on the floor, and put something on my feet. Then I see from underneath the hood that it is a machine with electrodes that are then attached to my genitals. Now I understand that, in addition to the blows I can't see coming, and therefore can't even contract my body to cushion the impact of, I'm about to get electric shocks. I tell them they don't have to do this. I'll confess whatever they want me to confess. I'll sign whatever they want me to sign. But they are not satisfied. Then, in desperation, I begin to scratch my skin, tearing off pieces of myself. The torturers must have been frightened when they saw me covered in my own blood. They leave me alone. They say I can take off the hood when I hear the door slam. I take it off and see that I'm in a soundproof room with bullet holes on the walls. That explains the raised floor. The modern defenders of Brazil's dictatorship protest that the generals only killed hundreds of people, but it was not through internal suppression that Brazil had the biggest impact on the mass murder programs that shaped the world we occupy today. In the early 1970s, under Médici, Brazil began intervening across South America, creating brutal regimes in its own neighborhood that also served Washington's interests. As Tanya Harmer, the historian who has looked most closely at this short, influential, but often forgotten period, notes, the Brazilian dictatorship's body count is relatively low when compared to Chile or Argentina, but it was abroad that it had the most devastating impact on the intensification of the Cold War, both through its example, its interference in other countries' domestic politics, and its support for counter-revolutionary coups. Brazil's experience in and after 1964 was a game-changer that shaped the way in which the ideological battles of the 1970s were conceptualized and fought thereafter. Brazil helped establish violent anti-communist regimes in Bolivia and Uruguay. By 1976, much of South America was a killing zone of U.S.-backed regimes on its borders, which had employed Brazil as its prototype. But Brasilia's most notable right-wing foreign intervention took place over the west coast of South America in Pacific Chile. Allende arrives, barely. In 1970, Salvador Allende ran for office again in Chile, and again the CIA financed a scare campaign. Henry Kissinger, national security advisor to President Richard Nixon, approved the use of hundreds of thousands of dollars for a political warfare mission. I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people, Kissinger said. The agency fed propaganda to prominent reporters and got a story on the cover of Time that was heavily influenced by its materials. In Chile, the CIA relied heavily on El Mercurio, a right-wing paper that received agency funding and paid for posters, pamphlets, and messages painted on walls across the city. The efforts failed. Allende's Unidad Popular coalition won by a slim margin. A few days later, El Mercurio published a large special on Brazil. One headline read, Brazil, tomorrow is today. Over the next few months, the Brazilian military began plotting ways to help roll back socialism in Chile. Allende was both a socialist and an urbane member of Santiago's elite. He was a Marxist intellectual who enjoyed sipping red wine in silk tweed jackets. He admired Fidel Castro and considered him a close friend. but he thought the Chilean road to socialism could be very different. He'd work within the system and take advantage of a Cold War truce between Washington and Moscow, which he thought opened up space for La Vía Chilena, the peaceful Chilean way to socialism. When Richard Nixon was elected, he had sought détente with the Soviet Union, and as a result, the two superpowers pretended to ignore ideological disagreements with each other. But as it turned out, the truce didn't apply to the Third World. The chaos and violence in Chile was not caused by President Salvador Allende or the failures of his democratic socialist project. U.S.-backed right-wing terrorism began before he even took office. Under Chilean law, Congress had to ratify Allende's election since he had not won an outright majority. Under Chilean custom, this was a formality. Nixon viewed it differently. He ordered the head of the CIA to find a way to stop Allende from taking over. Richard Helms emerged from the meeting with Nixon's orders written on a notepad. 1 in 10 chance, perhaps, but save Chile. $10 million available, more if necessary. Best men we have, make the economy scream. While Allende was waiting to take office in 1970, the CIA opened up activities on two tracks in Chile. Track one was political warfare, economic pressure, propaganda, and diplomatic maneuvers. CIA agents tried to bribe Chilean politicians and terrify the population. If all that failed, they would condemn Chile to utmost deprivation and poverty, Ambassador Edward Corey told Kissinger, hopefully forcing Allende to adopt the harsh features of a police state. They wanted Allende to abandon democracy. Track two was a military coup. The CIA began conspiring with right-wing military officers and funding a group of radicals that would grow into Patria y Libertad, an anti-communist terrorist group known for its hideous geometric spider logo and sympathies with fascism. Like Frank Wisner's early forays into Eastern Europe or the 1958 bombing of Indonesia, the 1970 CIA operation in Chile ended in total disaster. René Schneider, commander-in-chief of Chile's armed forces, was a constitucionalista, which meant that he believed the military should never overstep its constitutional role. Allende had won the election, so he should be president. Schneider was strongly opposed to a military coup that would stop that from happening. His stance on this was so uncompromising that it became known as the Schneider Doctrine. It also meant, as far as the CIA and its right-wing conspirators were concerned, he had to go. On October 25, 1970, a group of armed men tried to kidnap him and killed him in the process. The plan was to blame the whole thing on left-wing Allende supporters and therefore provide the justification for an anti-communist military coup. For placid, democratic Chile, this was a moment of unimaginable national trauma. Terrorists had murdered the head of the armed forces in the attempt to subvert an election. Things did not go exactly according to CIA plan. Schneider probably wasn't supposed to be killed. Maybe the wrong group carried out the wrong plan at the wrong time. At first, the agency didn't even know which of their local partners had done it. Most importantly, everyone in Chile found out who was really behind it. Instead of blaming the left, they correctly held right-wing terrorists responsible, and Chile's military rallied even more enthusiastically around the constitucionalista position. Allende was going to be president. But it's hard to avoid the nagging question, what if they had succeeded? What if they convincingly blamed some radical leftists, supporters of Allende, for carrying out a violent kidnapping, even when such an action was entirely unnecessary for them to take power? Would we still believe today that it was true? Would there be an anti-communist monument to Schneider in the center of Santiago, like the one in Jakarta? Instead, this was one of the CIA's notorious failures. Nixon was furious. Allende took over as president on November 3, 1970. For Chile's young leftists, it was a moment of unimaginable euphoria. Carmen Hertz was aligned with the MIR, the younger, more radical contingent of Chilean leftists who did not officially believe in electoral politics, but she voted for Allende anyway, as so many of her friends did. It was fantastic. Like everyone else, we flooded the streets when Allende's victory was announced, Carmen remembers. When we finally came home, we were full of hope and joy, even spiritual ecstasy. They had done it, and they would do it. Carmen remembers, I was convinced, just like everyone I hung out with, that we were going to change the world. Allende was a believer in the Third World Movement, and many of his supporters believed that global revolution was imminent and would be led by the Global South. Not long after Allende took power, Chile joined the Non-Aligned Movement and became increasingly active in Third World organizations. Fidel advised Allende against picking a fight with Washington, as did economist Orlando Letelier, a member of the so-called Elegant Left working at the Inter-American Development Bank. Castro also told Allende not to ignite Continental Revolution or incite the Yankees unnecessarily by being too revolutionary. For that reason, he did not attend Allende's inauguration. Castro knew it was best not to provoke the gringos. As in Guatemala, it was clear what Washington really considered a threat in Chile. It was not an alliance with the Soviet Union. Indeed, Allende went to Moscow and came back largely empty-handed. The Soviets continued to view Latin America as Washington's sphere of influence, and they maintained their long-held orthodox view that revolution should progress gradually in the Western Hemisphere. Allende had opposed aggressive Soviet moves in the international arena and had condemned the 1956 invasion of Hungary and Moscow's 1968 intervention in Czechoslovakia. Washington was not worried that Chile's economy would be destroyed under irresponsible left-wing mismanagement either, or even that Allende would harm U.S. business interests. What scared the most powerful nation in the world was the prospect that Allende's democratic socialism would succeed. Just days after Allende was elected, President Nixon convened his National Security Council. Nixon said, "Our main concern in Chile is that Allende can consolidate himself, and the picture projected to the world will be his success. If we let the potential leaders in South America think they can move like Chile and have it both ways, we will be in trouble. I want to work on this and on military relations, put in more money. On the economic side, we want to give him cold turkey, sick. We'll be very cool and very correct, but doing these other things, which will be a real message to Allende and others, no impression should be permitted in Latin America that they can get away with this." After Allende took office, the White House pushed for closer relations with Brazil as a way to counterbalance the perceived threat from Chile. Brazil was, at times, even more ferociously opposed to Allende than the United States. Brazil urged the U.S. to get more involved in South American affairs because they were working for the same goals. In 1971, the year that Brazil's military began to disappear its own dissidents, Médici's dictatorship helped to overthrow the government in Bolivia and install right-wing General Hugo Banzer as dictator. Evidence indicates Brasilia and Washington both supplied money and assistance for the August coup. A few months later, Uruguay had an election. It appeared the left-leaning Frente Amplio coalition might win, so Brazil moved troops to the border and covertly interfered with the vote. Authorities handed the victory to the incumbent right-leaning Colorado Party. At the very end of 1971, Médici met with Nixon in Washington. The Brazilian leader told the president his dictatorship was in contact with Chilean military officers and working to overthrow Allende. He told Nixon, "We should not lose sight of the situation in Latin America, which could blow up at any time." Médici said that Brazil could assist organizing 1 million Cuban exiles to fight back against Castro and urged more action in South America. This was not because he thought the Russians were plotting something. Exactly the opposite. Médici was recorded as saying that he did not believe that the Soviets or the Chinese were interested in giving any assistance to these countries' communist movements. They felt that communism would come all by itself because of the misery and poverty in these countries. The problem for both men, in other words, was not an international communist conspiracy. The problem was that they thought the Soviets and Chinese might be right. The impoverished people in Brazil's neighboring countries might choose communism all by themselves, and they had to be stopped. Nixon was very impressed with Médici. He privately told Secretary of State William Rogers that he wished Médici were running the whole continent. Then, before the general left the United States, Nixon made a toast at a farewell banquet. He proclaimed, "Where Brazil goes, Latin America will follow." The same year, back in the United States, former Ambassador Howard P. Jones published his memoir on Indonesia, The Possible Dream, reflecting on the failures of U.S. policy in Asia. It didn't make much of a splash. At the same time, the world was living through another anti-communist massacre. The Communist Party of Sudan, the largest of the remaining Bandung-era communist parties, in the 1960s it was in third place, behind the parties in Indonesia and Iraq, both of which had since been annihilated, attempted a coup against a new regime that was trying to destroy it. When the coup failed, the Ghaffar Nimeiri government liquidated the opposition. The order was to destroy anyone who claims there is a Sudanese Communist Party. This didn't make much of a splash in the West, either. Operation Jakarta. As the Brazilian government collaborated with right-wing forces in Chile, the word Jakarta was put to new use. In both countries, the capital of Indonesia now had the same meaning. Operação Jakarta, or the Jakarta Operation, was the name of a secret part of an extermination plan, according to the documentation compiled by Brazil's Truth Commission. Testimony gathered after the fall of the dictatorship indicates Operação Jakarta may have been part of Operação Radar, which was aimed at destroying the structure of the Brazilian Communist Party. The goal of Operação Jakarta was the physical elimination of communists. It called for mass murder, just as in Indonesia. Before the Jakarta operation, the dictatorship had aimed its violence at open rebellions. Operação Jakarta was a hidden plan to expand state terror to Communist Party members operating openly with civil society groups or in the media. The Brazilian public would not hear the words Operação Jakarta until 3 years later, but in Chile, the word Jakarta made a very public arrival. Around Santiago, especially in the eastern part of the city, up in the hills where the well-to-do people lived, someone began to plaster a message on the walls. It took a few forms. Jakarta viene. Jakarta se acerca. That is, Jakarta is coming, or sometimes simply Jakarta. The events in Indonesia had been a part of right-wing discourse for years. Most significantly, Juraj Domic Kucinich, a Croatian anti-communist who wrote in right-wing outlets like El Mercurio and had maintained close contact with Patria y Libertad since 1970, had made frequent references to it since the 1960s. The first record of Jakarta appearing as a threat was in a January 1972 edition of El Rebelde, the official MIR newspaper. The cover asked, "What is Jakarta?" and on the inside showed a photo of the word slapped onto a wall. In a small article, La Vía Indonesia de los Fascistas Chilenos, the paper attempted to explain what the message meant. The Indonesian Communist Party had played an active role in an independent, progressive state, and then overnight, all that was left of its members was a sea of blood. At this point, not all of the left knew the Indonesian story, and the idea of a wave of violence here seemed far-fetched. The second article on Jakarta came out in February 1972 in Ramona, a Communist Party youth magazine. It claimed that the right wing had adopted something called Plan Jakarta and said it had gotten the plan from David Rockefeller or Agustin Edwards, the owner of El Mercurio. The Chilean extreme right wants to repeat that massacre, the article explained. What does that mean concretely? The terrorists have a plan which consists of killing the entire Central Committee of the Communist Party, the top of the Socialist Party, the national directors of CUT, the Central Unitaria de Trabajadores de Chile union organization, leaders of social movements, and all prominent figures on the left. The article was published on February 22nd, signed by Carlos Berger, the Communist Party member who had argued with Carmen Hertz about left-wing tactics and the meaning of the Indonesian massacre when she was back at the University of Chile. Carlos and Carmen Hertz were now married. Wall painting was a popular political device in Santiago in the early 1970s. On the left, volunteer collectives painted murals with elaborate images created by young artists, inspired both by famous international muralists, such as Diego Rivera in Mexico, and by Chile's indigenous Mapuche culture. On the right, money pouring in from Washington or supplied by local elites was used to contract professional painters, who were both more efficient and less talented because they were used to plastering simple advertising messages. Patricio Pato Madera, a founding member of the left-wing Ramona Parra Brigade of Muralists, recognized the Jakarta graffiti as the handiwork of the same class of hired hands who had been painting right-wing slogans in recurring terror campaigns since 1964. But this was an escalation. it was a mass death threat. In addition to painting walls, they also sent out postcards. They arrived at the homes of officials and the left-wing government and Communist Party members. Sometime in 1972, Carmen Hertz and her husband got one. The paper was thin and flimsy. On the top, it said, "Jakarta is coming." On the bottom was the geometric spider, the Patria y Libertad logo. The terror campaign worked. Carmen and Carlos lived a life of 24-hour anxiety. They were on permanent maximum alert. All around them were sabotage, threats, and aggression. Only in her 20s, Carmen had been hired to work as a lawyer in the Allende government's land reform program and had seen just how violent the opposition could be. In addition to party activities and journalism, Carlos helped with public relations at the finance ministry. They both suspected that Washington was intentionally wrecking the economy, and mindful of domestic threats, the two of them often slept at work. They would only stay at home now and then, and never for too many days in a row. In the streets, they'd often exchange words with members of Tradición, Familia y Propiedad, TFP, the Chilean chapter of the anti-communist group founded in 1960 in Brazil. In Santiago, TFP youth would wear medieval-style tunics and were often protesting in the streets, ready to yell at Carmen. But when she got the postcard, "Jakarta se acerca," she felt even more in imminent danger. After she read it, Carmen heard a loud pounding on her door, and then shouting, "Comunista!" She yelled back. She took her newborn baby, Herman, in her arms, grabbed a pistol hidden in the house, and ran to the street, pointing it back and forth wildly. She shot it into the sky. She only realized later, as her heart stopped pounding so badly, that she was still holding on to Herman as she fired. She couldn't sleep at home that night, so she tried to flag down a bus to get to Carlos's childhood home. None came, so she walked down the chilly streets of Santiago with the baby gripped tightly against her body. The rifts in Chilean society split Carmen's own family down the middle. She knew that her mother, whom she loved, may have been more sympathetic to those right-wingers than she was to her own daughter. It was always patient Carlos who tried to mend their relationship, who always insisted on visiting Herman's grandmother, and tried to laugh and calm them down as they inevitably fought. But Carmen and Carlos thought history was on their side. They were at battle, yes, but they were playing by the rules. They had the people behind them, and so they thought they would win. They also believed the country was suffering from foreign sabotage, and on this count, they were certainly right. The CIA, working with its far-right partners, was trying to ruin the economy and doing its best to make it look like it was Allende's fault. The most obvious problem for Allende's government was probably a nationwide strike in October 1972. Truckers, who were indirectly receiving funding from Washington, brought transportation to a halt, meaning regular people were left without basic supplies. Once the strike started, the CIA did its best to keep it going. It was not just economic sabotage, however. Track 2 never really ended, said one CIA officer, meaning that since 1970, the agency had never stopped looking for ways to organize a coup. The officer's notes from the time record Kissinger saying, "Since Allende is holding himself out as a moderate, why not support extremists?" The thing about destabilizing a country is you don't need surgical precision. A pretty big hammer works. Soon, Chile was in chaos, and as a result, Allende was forced to skip his much-anticipated trip to the Conference of the Non-Aligned Movement in Algeria. But there were still two major problems. First, Allende would be in power for at least another 3 years, and the left still had plenty of support among the public. Still, the same circumstance had not stopped the coup in Brazil. The second problem, the real obstacle, was that Carlos Prats, the man who took over as head of the armed forces after René Schneider, was also a constitucionalista. He saw that there was an economic crisis and that conservatives were clamoring for a military coup, but he was loyal to the Schneider doctrine and to democracy, so he refused to step outside of his legal role. Allende remained in power. At the end of 1972, the world gained another anti-communist dictatorship. Since 1970, students had been protesting the government of Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, both for his blatant corruption and his government's collaboration with the U.S. war in Vietnam. The Philippines was the site of Washington's largest experiment with direct colonial rule, and its independence had been carefully managed to keep Manila in the Western camp, ever since the CIA had defeated the left nationalist Hucks using terror and psychological warfare in 1954. U.S. bases in the Philippines were used in 1958 when the CIA attempted to break up Indonesia. The right-wing Marcos, re-elected under slightly suspicious circumstances in 1968, and his wife Imelda were close friends of California Governor Ronald Reagan, who attended the gala opening of Imelda's lavish, multi-million-dollar cultural center. Some of the anti-Marcos students were followers of communist José María Joma Sison, a Maoist literature professor inspired by Lumumba, Castro, and Western New Left intellectuals. Sison studied in Indonesia before the fall of Sukarno and came to the conclusion in 1965-66, just like Pol Pot, that the unarmed PKI had left itself too vulnerable. In 1968, he founded the Maoist Communist Party of the Philippines, CPP, which relied on guerrilla groups in the countryside rather than the open mass party tactics that PKI employed. Sison told me that what he saw in Indonesia in 1965 convinced him the CPP had to be armed and clandestine, and the party is active to this day. But many of those anti-Marcos protesters were simply supporters of the centrist Liberal Party. Marcos himself was behind others. Disorders must now be induced into a crisis so that stricter measures can be taken, he wrote. A little more destruction and vandalism, and I can do anything. Marcos and his defense secretary, Juan Ponce Enrile, repeatedly warned of a communist threat. Then, on September 22, 1972, Enrile faked an attempt on his own life. He took a different car as gunmen lit up the car he was supposed to be in. He and Marcos, who helped plan the ruse, said God had saved him. Of course, they blamed the communists. They also claimed, on the same day, that all of this left them no choice but to declare martial law. Military units fanned out to arrest opposition leaders, the first of whom was the Liberal Party Senator Benigno Aquino Jr. Suharto already had an anti-communist ally in Marcos, but now he and Washington had a friendly authoritarian regime in Southeast Asia's second most populous country. Marcos, with active U.S. support, created his own version of crony capitalism with record-setting levels of corruption. He went on to kill thousands of people, often dumping their bodies in public in order to terrorize his enemies. Marineros Constitucionalistas. As 1973 started, Pedro Blaset was 23, a working-class sailor in Chile's traditionally more upper-class conservative navy. He was lucky enough to hop on a cruiser trip to Switzerland for 6 months and had missed much of the radicalization back home. In Europe, he and his shipmates were shocked at how liberally navies were organized in contrast to the strict Prussian traditions in Chile. When he first entered the service, he was beaten as a form of hazing, and when he and some friends celebrated Allende's victory in 1970, they were reprimanded. The deeply conservative naval officers, usually privately educated and self-consciously aristocratic, had not even liked the CIA-backed Eduardo Frei government much. As Blaset understood it, their main problem was that his modest reforms brought some members of the middle class into their elite schools, and their children were forced to study with their inferiors. But when Pedro got back to Santiago in February 1973, things were different. The Navy was likely the most anti-communist branch of the military, and his colleagues weren't hiding their feelings. The high officers talked about their collaborations with the Brazilian embassy. They spoke about passing weapons to Patria y Libertad. They savagely critiqued Army leader Prats for his constitutionalist stance, especially after the left did well in the March elections. They began to talk quite openly about something called El Plan Jakarta. Pedro had heard tales about Jakarta before. Not long after he entered the Navy in 1966, sailors began trading horror stories from a particularly strange trip through Southeast Asia. They said they'd witnessed the carnage caused by an extermination program in the Indonesian capital. Stories about loose heads on spikes terrified the young sailors as they took in tales of fantastical violence from a distant land. But when his superiors started talking about El Plan Jakarta in 1973, they were being very specific and very serious. The plan was to kill around 10,000 people, the left and its core supporters, as a way of ensuring a stable transition to a right-wing government. Pedro and his friend Guillermo Castillo heard this being discussed on more than one boat. If we just put the Jakarta plan into place, kill 10 or 20,000, then that's it, one officer said. Then that's all the resistance, and we win. Perhaps their superiors figured their underlings were on board with this kind of strategy, or at least respected the internal Navy hierarchy enough to keep quiet. But this wasn't normal to low-ranking sailors. Who are they talking about killing? Our families? Pedro asked a few of his closest friends. What happened to Chile while I was gone? They decided to meet up, form a small clandestine constitucionalista group within the Navy, and talk about the situation. They figured their oath was to the country, not their immediate superiors, so they decided to pass a warning on to politicians. They were discovered. Pedro and Guillermo were imprisoned by the Navy and tortured repeatedly. They would not see the light of day until well after a Chilean version of Plan Jakarta was indeed put into effect. Operação Jakarta, Jakarta Viene, Plan Jakarta. In both Spanish and Portuguese, in all three ways it was used, it's clear what Jakarta meant, and it's a far cry from what the word meant back in 1948 when the Truman administration was guided by the Jakarta Axiom. Back then, Jakarta stood for independent third world development that Washington need not view as a threat. Now, Jakarta meant something very different. It meant anti-communist mass murder. It meant the state-organized extermination of civilians who opposed the construction of capitalist authoritarian regimes loyal to the United States. It meant forced disappearances and unrepentant state terror. And it would be employed far and wide in Latin America over the next two decades. Operation Condor. In 1973, Allende fell. He died, and so did the Chilean dream of democratic socialism. In its place emerged a violent anti-communist regime that worked with Brazil and the United States to form an international extermination network. Their murderous terror was not only reserved for the left, they also unleashed it on former allies who got in the way. In the months before September 11, 1973, Chile had a good deal in common with Brazil in 1964. Private sector groups were funding opposition groups, pro-tradition and family groups were organizing protests, and the right-wing media was spreading fears of a putative left-wing plot. The CIA reported at the end of 1972 that Chilean opposition groups were receiving economic assistance and weapons, such as machine guns and hand grenades, from Brazil's dictatorship. But the days after September 11, 1973, looked more like Indonesia in 1965, though on a smaller scale. At first, while Brazil's military government moved only slowly toward terror, General Augusto Pinochet's dictatorship began with an explosion of violence. The first coup attempt came in June. The Tanquetazo, as it was called, failed largely because Carlos Prats, leader of the armed forces, put down the military rebels allied with Patria y Libertad. Prats was not going to oversee the Chilean army while it betrayed its historic mission. In the weeks that followed, left-wing publications began to report that Patria y Libertad and other right-wing forces behind the coup had planned to activate Plan Jakarta if they had succeeded. It seems they had reason to be worried. One politician, Domingo Godoy Mate, from the right-wing National Party, actually stood up in Congress and declared that they, the nationalists, estarán aquí hasta que se produzca el Jakarta, will be here until Jakarta is produced. This inspired a wave of shocked condemnation on the center and left, furious accusations across a range of publications that the right was openly planning mass murder. The Socialist Party paper displayed a postcard that had been sent to its editorial director with the words, "Jakarta is coming." The paper blamed the United States. Strangely, right-wing media began to run an inverted version of the Jakarta terror meme. El Mercurio, the CIA-funded paper, reproduced the story that communists had massacred generals in Indonesia and could do so in Chile, too. In 1970, Castro had warned Allende against provoking Washington. It was too late for that now. As right-wing terror and coup plotting built up around the Chilean president, Castro advised him to start taking a harder line. He said Allende gave too much freedom to the opposition and was too unwilling to use violence to advance his revolution. He warned that a confrontation between socialism and fascism loomed on the horizon, and if Chile's left didn't take his advice, they would not survive it. But Allende's Unidad Popular government remained committed to democratic socialism. In July, right-wing terrorists killed another military official, Arturo Araya, Allende's aide-de-camp, as he stood on the balcony of his home. By August, Carlos Prats had realized there was too much pressure on him. Powerful elements in the military wanted a coup. So did much of the elite, as evidenced by the groups of military wives protesting outside his home. And it seemed the right-wing terrorists running wild would rather kill General Prats than let Allende finish his term. All three of those groups had the backing of the most powerful government in history, but Prats wasn't going to give them their coup. On August 23rd, he handed in his resignation and got ready to take off for Buenos Aires. He was replaced by Augusto Pinochet, an unremarkable, laconic general who had been loyal to Prats and had shown no particular inclination toward a coup just a few weeks earlier. After the failed June Tanquetazo, Pinochet had told a meeting of coup plotters that he did not want to talk about politics because that is against the Constitution. On September 9th, Carlos Altamirano, the leader of the Socialist Party, gave a speech at the National Stadium in Santiago. He read a letter delivered to the government by the group of Constitucionalista sailors like Pedro Blaset and Guillermo Castillo, attempting to warn them about plots for a coup in August. For us, it was vital to avoid that great massacre that they planned to commit against the people between August 8th and 10th, he read from the letter. Our boss has explained to us that for this or that reason, the Marxist government should be overthrown and the people should be washed of its Marxist leaders. For them, every left-wing leader would get, without a doubt, the Jakarta Plan. By then, it would have been clear to most left-wing Chileans what the Jakarta Plan meant. By then, it was also clear to almost everyone that a coup was imminent. Altamirano's speech was more of an homage to the sailors' bravery than a news flash. 2 days later, on September 11th, Salvador Allende knew what was coming. He barricaded himself in La Moneda Presidential Palace and gave a final radio address to his supporters. "Surely this will be my last opportunity to speak to you. The Air Force is now already bombing the antennas. I will pay with my life for my loyalty to the people, and I tell you all that I am certain that the seed we have planted in the conscience and thousands of Chileans cannot be held back forever. Viva Chile, viva el pueblo, viva los trabajadores. Long live Chile, long live the people, long live the workers. These are my last words, and I am sure my sacrifice will not be in vain." He took his machine gun, Fidel Castro had given him one as a gift, slung it over his shoulder, and put on an army helmet. As the Chilean Air Force bombarded the presidential palace and strafed poor communities they thought might want to defend the president, Allende shot himself in the head. That night, the new military junta made it exceedingly clear which ideology had propelled their violent rise to power. In a televised address to the nation, General Jorge Gustavo Ley, one of its four members, said, "After 3 years of supporting the Marxist cancer, we consider ourselves obligated in the sacred interest of our country to accept the sad and painful mission we have undertaken. We are ready to fight against Marxism and willing to eradicate it to the very end." The murder and disappearances started right away. Fanatical anti-communism, once more, was the founding ideology for a new murderous regime in the global South. Internationally, the junta would be a close ally of the United States, but locally, they didn't want to emulate the U.S. They wanted to emulate Brazil. The junta began establishing a dictatorship and justifying their own existence. On September 22nd, Tribuna, the Chilean National Party paper, published a curious interview with General Ernesto Baeza Mikkelsen. He posed for a photo with a postcard identical to the one that Carmen Hertz and Carlos Berger received at their home. "Jakarta is coming," it read. In this case, however, the general claimed that it was actually the left that was sending upstanding conservative officers the threatening message. According to this story, now backed with the full weight of a U.S.-supported military dictatorship, the Marxist had planned to kill all 27 high-ranking officers on September 22nd, and only the right-wing coup had stopped the murderous left-wing coup from taking place. A few days later, General Jorge Gustavo Ley, one of the original members of the military junta, told the same story. He said to the newspaper La Segunda, This campaign was destined to totally destroy the armed forces, a Jakarta that would permit a final collapse. Once this last bastion had fallen, they were going to impose terror on our country. As this was published on September 22nd, it was the junta that was terrorizing the nation. Famously, they rounded up thousands of suspected enemies of the regime at the Estadio Nacional for questioning, torture, and execution. Less well known is that Brazilian military advisors were there, helping the Chileans to destroy the young men and women they both considered enemies. More than 1,000 were immediately executed, their bodies hidden in mass graves. But Carmen Hertz and Carlos Berger weren't among them. They were in the north of the country, where Carlos had been working as a communications officer at the Chuquicamata copper mine, desperately trying to play defense for Allende's nationalization of the copper industry. Carlos was arrested on September 12th, but quickly released. When he was arrested again on September 14th, he stayed in. Carmen, the young lawyer, tried to arrange for his early release. She was sure he would get out. The question was how soon. Since she knew his fate was in the balance, she didn't contact the Communist Party or any other higher-ups in Santiago. She stayed close to him, visiting as much as she could, negotiating with the local officials. His sentence was technically 61 days, and Carmen hoped to commute that down to time served. On October 19th, she visited the jail at about 5 in the afternoon. Carlos was distraught, nervous. Something was wrong. They took away a group of prisoners. It was some kind of command, a different group. I didn't recognize anyone from the regiment, said Carlos. They took them away violently, with hoods over their heads. Later that night, Carmen got an anonymous call. They had taken him away, the voice said. She called the warden. Yes, they took him, but don't worry, it's just interrogation and they'll be right back. He didn't come back. They executed all of them. Jakarta had arrived. In their own way, Pinochet's forces eventually confirmed this to her. The next night, they parked a jeep on the road and waited for her to approach. They didn't get out of the car. As she approached, she could see that it was a military priest and someone else, someone in a uniform. That man said, Carlos Berger and the other prisoners were being driven to the city of Antofagasta. They rebelled on the way, attempted to escape, and were subsequently killed. Hasta luego. The motor was still running. The driver shifted the car into gear and rolled away. Carmen didn't cry. She screamed. Murderers! Murderers! Sons of bitches you will see! You will pay for this! Murderers! Wretched cowards! Officials in Washington watched as developing countries across the world reacted with shock and horror to the rise of Pinochet. An October State Department intelligence report noted that a moderate Cameroonian newspaper called Allende's downfall a slap in the face of the Third World. Juraj Domic, the Croatian exile who introduced the Jakarta metaphor into Chilean politics, was given a job in Pinochet's foreign ministry. Before the coup, plotters in Washington were worried the Chileans didn't have what it took to fight socialism, but the Chileans soon surpassed their Brazilian patrons in zeal. The military command was willing to tolerate thousands of deaths, just as Pedro Blaser and other Constitucionalista sailors had overheard. In the end, Pinochet and his men killed around 3,000 people, mostly in the early days of his dictatorship. They were proud of their efficiency. Manuel Contreras, a close collaborator with the CIA who created Pinochet's deadly DINA secret police, knew that the point of state terror was not just wanton destruction of enemies, but to make resistance impossible and solidify the dominant political and economic structures. Terrorism had to be unleashed on the population before one man, Augusto Pinochet, agreed to take on the role Washington thought Chile's military was supposed to play. Washington favored Pinochet's government from the very start. Henry Kissinger had a very simple policy regarding South America's new dictator. Defend, defend, defend. However, just as with Brazil's military dictatorship, the consequences of Pinochet's violence were far from limited by the borders of his own narrow country. Almost immediately after taking power, he sought to influence events abroad, both by fighting communism throughout the hemisphere and by executing civilians around the world. The international terror began close to home. On September 29, 1974, Pinochet's secret police murdered Carlos Prats, his former boss, and his wife at their home in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Prats had been preparing his memoirs. After murdering him, Pinochet put out a statement saying his death justifies the security measures the government has adopted. A few months after Prats was killed, the Brazilian military let slip the existence of its own Operação Jacarta. In August 1975, Luciano Martins Costa was a journalism student in São Paulo. He and other students were able to interview a general named Ednardo Davila Mello, who had a reputation for brutality. Military officers had investigated the young journalists before the interview, of course, and they brought in right-wing students to the interview itself to pack the room as a sort of intimidation tactic. As these things always went, Davila Mello delivered pleasant half-truths about the regime while giving it an air of transparency. The problem was, the general became incensed with one of the students' questions. He became enraged at what he saw as her insubordinate attitude. He lost it. "You're all indoctrinated," he screamed, "and it's because of this indoctrination that we're going to put into effect Operation Jacarta and neutralize 2,000 communists right here in Sao Paulo." He began to list the names of targets. Luciano scribbled down furiously, "Neutralizar 2,000 comunistas em Sao Paulo." The general had gone off script. This was a dictatorship, however, and he had an easy way to make sure it stayed off the record. "If you publish a single line of what I just said, it will be 2001. The students kept quiet for quite some time. 3 months later, Pinochet's regime held a meeting with representatives from Brazil and their like-minded U.S.-backed anti-communist neighbors. There were a lot of them now. Representatives from Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay met with Manuel Contreras, collaborator with the CIA and founder of Chile's secret police, in the Grand Hall of Chile's War Academy. It was an upbeat meeting. They needed to work together, they had decided. It wasn't enough just to kill communists and subversives in their own countries. They set up a program to collaborate to exterminate their enemies around the world. They established a central data bank in order to trade intelligence. The computers for that system would soon be provided by the United States. The first day ended with a gala dinner with attractive Chilean women supplied by the secret police. They named their new alliance after Chile's national bird, the majestic scavenger. In November 1975, they launched Operation Condor. A trip to the movies. Benny arrived in Chile in 1975. He had been transferred from his job in Bangkok after more than a decade there to work as a UN economist. Back in Kansas, he had gotten a taste of North America, but this was his first time living in Latin America, and of course he was excited. He arrived with his wife and children, who did their best to learn the language. They learned very quickly what life was like under Pinochet. One evening, Benny decided to take a stroll through central Santiago and catch a movie. On the way, a couple carabineros, members of the Chilean police, stopped him on the street. They needed to know who he was and where he was going. It was suspicious that he was even walking. There was a curfew in Santiago, and it was approaching, but it was also his race that fueled their suspicion. Just as being Chinese had led the U.S.-backed military to harass his community, and Suharto's dictatorship forced him to officially change his name to Benny Widiono while working in Bangkok, his face inspired suspicion in Chile, too. By this point in his life, Benny spoke enough Spanish to understand what the cop said next. ¿Quiere que lo lleve? Do you want me to take you away? The subtext was clear as day to Benny. Do you want me to take you in, to be tortured, and maybe never come out? Do you realize you can be disappeared tonight? Benny tried to be as polite with the cop as possible. It worked. The guy was just trying to intimidate him a bit, which also worked, and Benny was able to walk away. But over his first few weeks in Chile, he realized that not even his plush UN office was a refuge from the chaos of this violent dictatorship. Or rather, the chaos arrived there because it was a refuge. As Benny and his colleagues worked, young Chileans would run to the UN compound, fleeing the regime, and jump over the walls. Inside, they couldn't be arrested by the secret police, as the UN facilities, nestled onto the south bank of the Mapocho River, had a little bit of autonomy from the regime. These young men and women were mostly members of the left-wing MIR party, which had heeded the warning of the 1965 massacre in Indonesia and subscribed to the doctrine of armed revolution. Benny watched as the kids kept coming and coming and set up a mini encampment inside, sleeping on mattresses on the floor and looking for a way out of the country. They probably didn't know that Operation Condor could hunt them down anywhere on Earth, even if they did get out. Pinochet hated Benny's office. For him, the whole UN was basically a hive of communists. But even worse, Benny worked at the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, CEPAL. This was a bastion of what Pinochet and his global allies considered unacceptably leftist economic thought. CEPAL was the epicenter of development economics and dependency theory. Chile's new dictator, on the other hand, had elevated a group of well-connected Chilean economists who had studied at the University of Chicago and favored a radical turn toward free market economics. This group, which came to be known as the Chicago Boys, were far more zealous than even Benny's old acquaintances in the Berkeley Mafia back in Indonesia. Their ascendance was not planned. The Pinochet government's raison d'etre was anti-communism, not market fundamentalism, but under these economists, Chile became the world's first test case for neoliberal economics, and Benny's CEPAL offered advice that was no longer welcome. But still, Benny was soon invited to fancy events in Barrio Alto, the eastern neighborhoods up toward the hills where the elite lived. When you stand in downtown Santiago and look east, it's almost always breathtaking. You can usually see snow capping the peaks of the Andes, towering above you, while down below you stroll through warm air thick with the smell of tropical spices. It was when Benny went up the hill a bit into the posh neighborhoods that he first saw them. Jakarta viene, Jakarta se acerca, or just Jakarta. It was a surprise. He had to ask around to figure out exactly what the graffiti meant, where all the slogans came from. He found out, and that was even more of a shock. The capital of his own country had come to mean not cosmopolitanism, not third world solidarity and global justice, but rather reactionary violence. Jakarta meant brutal elimination of people organizing for a better world. And now he was in another country, also backed by the U.S., whose governing forces celebrated that history rather than condemning it. The paint was everywhere, but it was slowly fading. The coup, only 2 years old now, had been rewritten into a new history by the victors. That was a process he knew very well. There was another similarity with Indonesia that Benny noticed right away. Allende, like Sukarno, was a talker. Pinochet, like Suharto, never really said much. Sometimes Chilean TV would transmit video of a recent Pinochet speech, but dub over his voice to fix what he had actually said. Even the present could be rewritten. Benny had to get used to seeing Jakarta plastered all around, but it never sat well with him. And one day, all these emotions came pouring out. The Indonesian ambassador to Argentina came to give a lecture to Chilean students alongside Benny, who was often the closest thing his country had to an ambassador in Santiago. This meant working with Suharto's government, but like most Indonesians, Benny had resigned himself to that reality. After the lecture, students pressed the ambassador on how and why the Chilean government looked to Jakarta for an example of glorious anti-communist terror. What was the meaning of all that graffiti? The ambassador was furious. "That's simply the name of our capital. How dare you imply it's synonymous with massacre?" Benny was angry too. But were the students actually wrong? He had to face this. He knew the whole city of Jakarta in its dirty, beautiful complexity. But outside the country, here in Chile, all that arrived was the story of mass murder. A mass murder that absolutely happened, that Pinochet had somehow replicated here. The graffiti wasn't slander. It was reality. Later, he reflected on this more deeply. He thought back on his own life, to his time in Kansas in the late 1950s and early 60s. He thought of those Indonesian military men coming over to eat Indonesian food at his home and then going out on the town. It was then that those men were being trained by the United States in the ways of violent, fanatical anti-communism. It was those men who returned to Jakarta after nights of strip clubs and heavy drinking with Benny to help carry out the world's most notorious right-wing extermination program. That's where it all started. Back in Kansas, he thought. That's why the name of the city I grew up in, where I studied, where I learned about socialism and marched against colonialism and racism, has become a synonym for mass murder.